Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Practice Groups, was recorded on Thursday, December 7th, 2017, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members.
Welcome to the Practice Group's teleforum conference call, as today we discuss the new book, Written Out of History, The Forgotten Founders Who Fought Big Government, with author Senator Mike Lee. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups here at the Federal Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're going to hear opening remarks of 10 to 15 minutes from the Senator, as always, followed by questions from our audience, so please have those in mind. A special announcement, this is a 30-minute teleform conference call, so we're going to adjourn at about the 3 o'clock hour Eastern time. With that, Senator Lee, thank you for joining us. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Dean, and thanks to all of you who have joined us. It's a real honor and a privilege to get to talk to you about my book, Written Out of History. This is something I wrote in order to help promote the message of limited government that prompted my decision to run for the United States Senate for the first time in 2010 and again for re-election in 2016. I got into the business of politics after being a longtime lawyer before that, based on my love and dedication to the Constitution, and based on my belief that the structural protections in the Constitution, most importantly, federalism and separation of powers, are essential to preserving liberty. Without federalism and separation of powers, we have no effective guarantee against government overreach, and there can be no meaningful freedom. Years ago, I was talking to my wife, Sharon, about how I could get more people to listen to these concepts. You know, I explained to her, these are great for people in the Federalist Society, but outside the limited world of the Federalist Society and a few other tight conservative circles, people don't talk enough about these concepts. She explained to me something that has stayed with me ever since then. She said, if you'll explain concepts in the form of a story, people will listen. If you'll tell them the stories behind these concepts and these provisions of the Constitution, it'll make a difference. People will start to see it differently. So this book, Written Out of History, is a culmination of years of effort to try to assemble stories that help establish some of these points. What I explain in this book is that there are a whole lot of our founders who don't fit into the traditional mold of who we think of the founding fathers. Many of them aren't founders at all. Some of the people I showcase in this book, founding mothers, are in fact white males. We think of all the founders as being white males, landowners, but not all of them were that. Some of the people I showcase in the book come from different racial backgrounds, and I wanted to share some of these stories with you before we open it up to questions. I wanted to tell a story first of all about Canasatego. Canasatego was an Iroquois Indian chief. He was from the Onondaga tribe. And we don't talk about Canasatego much anymore, in part because we don't talk about federalism anymore, but we need to. Let me explain what I mean. Benjamin Franklin got to know Canasatego at a conference in Albany back in 1744. It was there that Benjamin Franklin came to understand the system of government under which the Iroquois Confederacy operated. This Confederacy operated for centuries peacefully, very basic principles underlying the Confederacy as a whole. One of them was that they were stronger than the sum of their parts, used arrows to explain that take 5 arrows together, you bind them, they are going to be stronger than any arrow could be in isolation. And he also explained that key to their prosperity and success within the Confederacy was the fact that while they operated as a single nation for national purposes, for purposes related, for instance, to their common defense, they held sacrosanct the right of each tribe to govern locally on local intra-tribe matters. And in that respect, they found their strength in that concept of limiting the government of the Iroquois Confederacy. They were able to succeed and to thrive. Each tribe was able to do what it did best while not having to worry quite as much about attacks from the outside because they realized that their defense prospects would be much stronger. But Canasatego has drifted from our memory. We've forgotten about him in large part because we've forgotten about federalism. That's why my hope is to restore his name and the stories that go with him in hopes that we'll be able to bring back some of this understanding of federalism. You know, there are a whole lot of aspects of our system of government that we inherited in one way or another from Great Britain. It came to us from across the pond. Federalism isn't really one of them. It certainly didn't come from Great Britain. In fact, one of the reasons why we had a revolution to begin with is because we had a parliament operating in London that knew no boundary, recognized no limits around its power. We wanted a different kind of system than what we had had under parliament, and that's one of the reasons why we embraced federalism. Another story that I really enjoy telling from this book is of Mumbet. Mumbet, an African slave in colonial Massachusetts. Her master, Colonel John Ashley, was one of the key authors of a document called the Sheffield Declaration, a document that recognized the dignity of the human soul by recognizing that all human beings are free and equal in a state of nature. This is sort of a Lockean concept that was embodied in the Sheffield Declaration, written in the home of Colonel John Ashley, the master of this slave named Mumbet. Years after the Revolution, when the Massachusetts Constitution of 1780 was put together by John Adams utilized the Sheffield Declaration and worked that in to the Massachusetts State Constitution, acknowledging formally that under the Massachusetts Constitution, all human beings are free and equal. When Mumbet realized this same language that had been negotiated in her master's home had become part of the Massachusetts Constitution, it was now law of the land throughout Massachusetts, she decided to go seek legal counsel. And she went to the home of to the office of a young lawyer named Theodore Sedgwick, who had actually been in her master's home and helped negotiate the Sheffield Declaration. She said, look, if all humans are free and equal in Massachusetts, then why is it okay for another human being to exert ownership rights over me, to claim to own me? And Mr. Sedgwick thought it through, and after careful deliberation, decided to seek legal action on behalf of Mumbet. They filed a writ of replevin, seeking this common law remedy used for the return of personal property to its rightful owner. And as a result of a lot of travail within the court system, Mumbet was able to win her freedom. Now, this took place, nearly three quarters of a century before the Civil War. This took place at a time when there were a whole lot of slaves still living under the oppressive yoke of slavery in the United States. And even in Massachusetts, there were a lot of people in slavery. She didn't set out on her own. One of the things that I find most inspiring about Mumbet's story is that she explains that if at any moment prior to winning her freedom in court, someone had offered Mumbet a chance to live as a free woman for even 1 minute, she would take a chance. She would have to lose her life at the end of that minute. She said, I would have done that just to know what it felt like to live as a free woman for 1 minute on this earth. Her story is inspiring to me. I'd never tell that story without getting helps. It's inspiring to me on so many levels because Mumbet was someone who was willing to fight for freedom. I'm also inspired by the story of Elbridge Gerry. Elbridge Gerry is somebody who we know for the word gerrymandering. And in our popular culture, we rarely speak of him beyond that. Elbridge Gerry was one of just a small handful of founding fathers who attended both the Constitutional Convention and the event that led to the signing of the Declaration of Independence. He was one of only a small handful who signed the Declaration of Independence, who was at the Philadelphia the Convention of 1787. And of that small handful, he was the only one who refused to sign his name to the Constitution. He did so because he was concerned, quite presciently in retrospect, that the new government created under the new Constitution could end up creating a sort of monarchy in miniature, could end up leading to excesses of power, similar to those that we had recently escaped as a country through the revolution. Gary's warnings were way ahead of their time. And explained in the book, he pointed out all sorts of things that we ought to be concerned about, and that the government and its power need always to be limited. One of the many things I appreciate about Elbridge Gary is that he's one person who warned against the abuses that could come, Congress having too much power over federal public land. He issued a warning against the language that became known as the Enclave Clause, Clause 17 of Article 1, Section 8. He raised in September of 1787, toward the end of the convention, the possibility that this power could be abused, and that if Congress acquired a whole lot of land inside of a sovereign state's boundaries, that Congress could use that power, use its power as the sole sovereign lawmaking authority over such land, to compel the host state to a humble obedience to the general government. This concern was addressed by a minor tweak to the Enclave Clause, one that limited the sole sovereign lawmaking authority over federal enclaves to those purchased by the consent of the host state's legislature. But it's one of many, many examples of Elbridge Gary pointing out potential for abuse. He was also very concerned about the absence of a Bill of Rights and wanted to make sure that there were additional limitations placed on the federal government. Elbridge Gary was the author of one variation of the 10th Amendment, and his version was a little bit different than the one that passed. His version, unlike the Madison version that ended up becoming part of the Constitution, would have said that all powers not expressly granted to Congress or prohibited to the state, be reserved to the states. And the word expressly was removed, of course. And in many respects, this is an example of the prescience of Elbridge Gary in his ability to recognize in advance that there would be a tendency within the federal government to exceed Congress's limited enumerated powers. At the end of the day, this is a book that I think can be accessible to anyone. I wrote it in such a way as to make it easy to understand and captivating, engaging, to tell the story in a series of running narratives so that people can understand some of the personalities behind the Constitution, including some of the personalities of those whose stories have been neglected, forgotten, or as I mentioned in the title of the book, written out of history. But with that, let's open it up to questions, and I'd love to hear any questions you might have about this book.
Terrific. Thank you so much, Senator. In a moment, we should all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for our guest, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. If I could ask my colleague, Laura, to activate the floor mode. Go ahead, Laura. So we've got the floor mode on now. If you have a question for our expert, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone to indicate you have a question. If you've joined us late, we're speaking with Senator Mike Lee. He's the author of the new book, Written Out of History, The Forgotten Founders Who Fought Big Government. I got the book, and I recommend it. It is accessible, as the senator says, which means that I think it would make an ideal Christmas gift. It's that time of year. If you've got somebody in mind and you don't have a gift picked out for them, it's available on Amazon.com, of course, in bookstores everywhere. We've got two callers with questions now. Open the floor to questions. Let's see if we can take our first call of the day.
Senator Lee, this is Robert Howard. I'm a lawyer in Wichita, Kansas. I don't have any question. I just really admire your contributions to championing limited government and another great book. And I just want to thank you for your great service. Keep it up.
Thank you very much, sir. I'm really deeply appreciative of your kind words about the book. I'm so glad you enjoyed it. I really feel strongly that if we can get people to learn these stories and make them once again part of our national political discussion, there's a lot we can do to improve the way our government works and to restore the dignity that all human beings are entitled to and that can be preserved only when governments recognize limits on their power. But to do that, we have to know the stories. And one of the central themes of this book is that History tends to be written by the victors. It tends to be written by the winners. That's an inevitable part of mortality, of existence on this planet. Yet in recent years, over the last 80 years, since the victors have been primarily progressives and those who have championed the consolidation of power in the hands of the few, particularly within the federal government, and the relinquishment of legislative power over to unelected, unaccountable bureaucrats, our history books in the last few decades have tended to focus on those who have been the winners in that regard, on those who have championed these big causes. It's one of the reasons why I'm pleased to hear you like the book, because I think it helps us tell other stories, stories that have been left out in the past.
The other problem is our legal profession has drifted increasingly toward supporting more and more governmental regulation because it's of its economic self-interest.
Yes, that's exactly right. And it results in a type of crony capitalism that operates not only through subsidies, but also through the natural exclusion on entry. The restrictions on entry that occur as a result of big regulations. Those big regulations make it relatively easy for established marketplace incumbents to operate, especially when the regulations are often written in consultation with, and sometimes even at the behest of, big players in the marketplace. So you're exactly right.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. I'll tell Laura that I have control of my laptop back now so I can monitor the board here. We've got three questions pending. If you joined us late, we're running to about 3 o'clock, maybe just a few minutes beyond that. We'll try and get as many questions as possible between now and then. Let's take another call.
Yeah, this is Tim Sendak. I'm in Indiana. I just wondering, Senator, on something that's very current and happening today in the Senate, all these allegations of sexual misbehavior, both by candidates and then by office holders, it seems lost in all of this, and I'm very much troubled by the allegations, but I'm also troubled that we don't seem to pay any attention to a rule of law called the presumption of innocence anymore. And I was wondering, don't we have to see these things through? I mean, if they admit it, that's one thing, like Franken did. But I don't know, as anybody else has, as ugly as the allegations may be, isn't that what they used to call the golden thread of the English common law?
Well, it certainly is, and nothing about that has changed or should change. I certainly hope we don't ever get to the point where someone can be deemed, meaning adjudicated, guilty by government without that presumption, without access to all the due process protections afforded by our Constitution, including the right to counsel, right to a jury trial, and so forth. But there is a distinction, I think, between the presumption of innocence, one that operates within our judicial system and our criminal justice processes, and on the other hand, the discussion that goes on in a contested political election. Allegations are made, and voters are made aware of them. Those can be discussed, and voters can make up their own minds as to how they might vote in an upcoming election in light of those accusations. And now, not everything can be ironed out in advance of every election in the same way that it could be in a court of law. And yet, they often are ironed out, at least to the satisfaction of voters. And so I hope in each circumstance that people will educate themselves based on the identity of the candidates, the policy positions they embrace, the statements made by the candidates, and the accusations against them.
Well, we now have four questions pending, so let's try and work our way through these calls. In the meantime, while we wait for that next caller, Senator, I have to say I was heartened about your statements about the structural protections of the Constitution, which is where if I was a betting man, I'd have to put my money on the structural protections, not so much the Bill of Rights. So I was heartened about that. Let me ask you, did you come across any surprises in your research or writing for the book?
Yeah, I did. And thanks for your comments about the structural Constitution. I've long been inspired by what Justice Scalia used to say which was that every tin-horn dictator around the world can have a Bill of Rights. Never quite understood what the difference between a tin-horn dictator and a non-tin-horn garden variety dictator is, but I assume there is a difference. But he said that the real distinction is made between those who are subject to structural protections and those who are not. If your system of government protects people against the excessive accumulation of power in the hands of the few, then liberty is going to prevail. If not, then it won't. To respond to the other part of your question about any surprises, yeah, I was a little bit surprised as I worked through this and as I did my research on it, discover how much more sympathetic to Aaron Burr than I was. I became a little more sympathetic to Aaron Burr relative to what I expected, and a little less sympathetic to Thomas Jefferson. Let me explain what I mean. At the beginning of my book, in chapter one, I talk about Aaron Burr and the fact that he was put on trial for treason during the second administration of Thomas Jefferson. Burr and Jefferson had had a longstanding feud, and during Jefferson's first term in office, while Burr had been his vice president, Burr, as vice president, had been president of the Senate and had presided over the impeachment trials of a number of Jefferson's political enemies who were subjected to impeachment and then removal trials in the Senate, in part because Burr had looked out for the rights of the accused and made sure that they got a fair trial. Many have speculated that that's why Jefferson was so eager to have Burr prosecuted, even under what some regarded as a fairly thin evidentiary foundation. I walk away from this not necessarily thinking that Thomas Jefferson was categorically a bad guy or that Burr was categorically a good guy, but there was a little more moral complexity to both of them than I had anticipated.
Great. I think we have a caller now from area code 612 unmuted. Go ahead, caller.
Yes, sir. This is Bill James with J-Pods, and I've read your book, and I like it, and this refers specifically to George Mason and the September 14th post-Rhodes vote. And the governor of Maryland just issued a rights of way to Hyperloop to start building networks there. We signed an agreement yesterday for a $600 million solar-powered mobility network in China. But this idea of restoring the post-Rhodes restriction and using that aspect of federalism where states are sovereign over internal improvements is laid out on the table right now and is going to have a big impact. And I'd like to see if you'd like to help get enforce that aspect of federalism.
I think it is very important to reestablish federalism. And I think in order to reestablish federalism, that means that we're going to have to start seeing states and municipalities saying that it's better for them to work that way, that not everything has to be decided by the federal government. Now, I am not one who takes a completely inflexible view on this. I think in the case of networks that are decidedly and rather unavoidably interstate in nature, it is appropriate for the federal government to play a role. But there are a whole lot of things about our transportation system that are not unavoidably national, that are not unavoidably interstate. And, you know, most surface roads are not interstate. And yet a whole lot of them now get federal funding. And because they get federal funding, they're subject to a whole host, a veritable raft of federal regulations that go along with them that make them more expensive, that make the process of building them more complicated and far more time consuming. It's one of the reasons why a lot of states and some municipalities are recognizing this and saying, look, we can do this cheaper, faster, and in a less complicated fashion if we undertake it ourselves rather than constantly going to Congress and seeking funding that way. The more we do that, I hope and expect, the more we will start to see the benefits of federalism even more broadly, and that not every decision has to be a federal decision. Federalism is more than just something the Constitution suggests is a good idea. It's a good idea because it works, because it allows more people to get more out of government more of the government they want and less of the kind of government they don't want.
Well, this is Dean. I was always amused to drive on the interstate highway in Hawaii, but I'll set that aside for now. It looks like we have a caller from area code 212 whose microphone is open now.
My name is Carl Beck, Carlos Beck from San Juan, Puerto Rico.
Go ahead, caller.
Do I have the phone?
Yes, we can hear. We can hear you fine. Go right ahead.
Thank you. First of all, I would like to say that Puerto Rico certainly could benefit from federalism. Since it isn't a state, it doesn't, because it's under the territorial clause. And part of the problems that Puerto Rico has are something that the Federalists pointed out. We have a lot of factions between the political parties here. And because we aren't a state, we don't have representation in Congress and that much interest in the federal government because we don't play a part of it, in it. And so it keeps us sort of looking at our own belly buttons all the time. And so I think that federalism certainly would help Puerto Rico if it were to become a state. But on the other hand, I think Puerto Rico would help federalism because since it is the oldest jurisdiction in the United States, discovered by Columbus in 1493, and here basically the culture is Spanish and the language is Spanish and the history, 500-year history, it does make us a little different. But that difference as a state would fortify federalism for the other states because it would sort of restore the notion that each state has a lot of things going forward. And this is something I used to see when I go to conferences in the states with the different states. Each state felt I was always impressed by the state fervor that people would express there and the pride they had in their own state. So I'm really interested in reading that book and after hearing your comments, Senator, on the people that you did mention there, I'm looking forward to reading it.
Thank you very much, sir. I appreciate your comments about Puerto Rico. I actually think Puerto Rico is a fascinating talking point for federalism right now. Oddly enough, it's a fascinating talking point for federalism because you've got the benefits of being U.S. citizens in Puerto Rico, and in some ways, in Puerto Rico, you've got even more of a right to self-determination than people in the states do. Let me explain what I mean. Puerto Rico has some additional flexibility that states don't have. You've got the same sort of flexibility that states is intended to have, but with our drift away from federalism, we've lost. Puerto Rico could decide, for example, that it wanted to be sort of the next Ireland. In other words, to offer very low tax rates in order to attract investment, in order to attract job creators and others. And I think within a relatively short period of time, it could revamp its entire economy if it wanted to offer a different set of tax laws and the regulatory structure than what you can find elsewhere in the United States. So quite ironically, Puerto Rico, not being a state, could end up having some of the benefits intended for states through federalism, and in the process help inspire a revitalization of federalism among and between the states.
Yes, sir.
That is quite a commentary on federalism as it stands today, isn't it? I pushed the button to see if we can get another caller here from area code 703. Stand by just a moment, if you could.
Hi, Senator. I'm wondering if all the veneration of our founding fathers forgets that, you know, we live in our own time and we've got a responsibility to govern in our own time. I know there's been a vibrant movement towards a constitutional convention, and I think that makes sense because our founders' oil was whale oil. They were an agrarian society. They didn't have to worry about the difference between musket loaders and grenades and where to draw the line and a populace's access to them. There were no national parks where people in New York had an interest in going out to Utah, for example, to see some natural wonders. I'm wondering if, like I said, the veneration of the founders gives us an easy way out in terms of not thinking about how we should govern ourselves and what a modern day constitution should look like.
Yeah, I understand your point. I think I come to a different conclusion than what you're suggesting. I don't think we over venerate our founding fathers, or at least maybe a better way of saying that is I don't think we should over venerate our founding fathers. And when you read this book, you will discover that I don't do that. I don't deify anyone. There's no apotheosis provided to any founder in this book. Quite to the contrary, my whole point in writing this book is to explain who these people were, to show them with their faults and with their strengths, but to tell their story so that we understand their story. What we're guilty of today, I think, is not venerating them too much. It's not talking about them at all. And in some ways it is, and maybe this is what you're getting at, in which case I agree with you. Maybe what you're getting at is that those stories that we do tell tend to over-venerate some of them because we tell a sanitized version of a small handful of stories from just a few founders. Just the way that some progressives today choose to identify themselves as champions of Alexander Hamilton, thinking that Hamilton somehow supports their liberal progressive political ideology, which his story really does not. But I think in order to understand them and from them, we've got to know their whole story. We've got to know what they were really like, what their animating stories were all about. But too often, for too many of us, too many of the founders, we just don't know their stories at all. And that's what this book seeks to correct. It's one of the reasons why I highly recommend this book as a gift, a Christmas gift, or a Hanukkah gift, or a gift for anyone who homeschools or wants to supplement their child's education or their own with something you're not likely to read about in textbooks.
The book,
Senator,
again,
I would just...
Go ahead, caller.
I would just add that it's maybe veneration is the wrong word. I think especially conservatives spend way too much time thinking about the founding fathers instead of thinking about our own legacy. What are we going to leave to our kids? How can we shape our government for our futures so that they may look back to us and try to, you know, spend some time wondering what made us great? I look at Congress and I look at the presidents over my lifetime in 40 years, and I see an America in decline. I saw it inclining in my parents' time, the greatest generation. And I can only put the blame for that on our leaders. And I need to know why aren't our leaders doing a better job, and are they spending too much time thinking about what came way before them instead of thinking about what they can do to be heroes for future generations?
Yeah, well, here again, I think a lot of our problems, a lot of our failure to lead has a whole lot to do with the fact that we don't think enough about where we've been. Yeah, some of that may involve over-veneration, especially if we do that to the exclusion of thinking about our own time. My point in this book is not to tell these stories just for the sake of telling them, but to tell the stories so that we can understand where others have been, that not all of our issues are unique to our time. Some of them are, and all of them take a different flavor with modern trends in our society, with modern technology. But a lot of these things are recurring motifs in history. We've got recurring themes that occur over and over again. And when we only tell part of the story, when we don't know all the stories of those who really made a difference in the founding of this country, we risk repeating that which we are most loath to repeat. In other words, history may not repeat itself, but it rhymes. And learn those rhyming couplets so that we can recognize them when we come along. We won't ever learn them unless we study them and unless we're made aware of them. But we've got a school system that is often averse to the idea of constitutionally limited government. And so we only tell part of some of the stories. I'm trying to change that with this book, so that we can focus, as you rightfully suggest, on making those changes that can benefit future generations that will come after us.
The title of the book, again, is Written Out of History, The Forgotten Founders Who Fought Big Government. Senator, we're beyond time, but do you have time for one question? I think we have one more question. I think we have Carter, our law school student, back.
Sure, you bet.
Carter, are you on?
Yes, thanks very much, Senator. To that last question, I concur in part and dissent in part. You know, as a member of the Judiciary Committee, thanks so much to Senator Grassley, yourself, and others who have done a lot, actually, to restore those constitutional protections that you've advocated. I'm just curious. So Director Ray was talking with Congressman Jordan this morning. I'm curious to hear your thoughts where the director said, you know, I don't believe we can share various FISA court submissions. And I know Senator Grassley, Senator Graham, and, you know, many other members of your committee have been requesting this for months. But speaking to your point about, you know, too much power in too few hands, I know there's some rogue bureaucrats that keep disclosing information and various other abuses, as we've learned over recent days, you know, in contradiction of their or overstepping their Article II powers. I'm just curious to hear your thoughts and in terms of these recent developments and ways of improving due process going forward. Thanks.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not familiar with the exchange this morning between Congressman Jordan and Director Ray. Tell me what transpired there.
Oh, he just had a quote. I don't believe I can legally and appropriately share a FISA court submission with this committee. But, you know, again, Senator Grassley and Senator Graham and others on your committee have been requesting that for months. And while they're not able to hand it over to Congress, you know, various bureaucrats have been disclosing a lot of information and illegally. And as we've seen over recent days, other oversteps of their power. So I'm just curious to hear your thoughts as to where you see things going in this regard.
There's no question that there are some things that our government does that have to be classified. Not every single thing can necessarily be made public. Plans for a military strike, for example, the planned invasion, the plan of attack on D-Day, for example, is something that had to be classified. One of many examples of things that have to be kept under wraps within government, lest they become self-defeating efforts. But one must delineate those categories very carefully, because if we're not careful and we start operating by secret law, that's a problem for liberty. Unless you can have a transparent process that allows the American people to know nearly all of what's going on in their government, then it's not a government of, by, and for the people at all. And it's certainly not a government that will allow for liberty to persist and to thrive more than just survive. So I get very nervous whenever people rely repeatedly on the assertion that what they are doing in government is so important that it cannot possibly be trusted with the peasants, meaning American citizens. I find that terribly frustrating, just as I found it frustrating when at times, as a member of the United States Senate, I've been told that I can't read a classified annex to certain bills because I don't have membership on the right subcommittee. That's wrong. It's also wrong when we allow our government to undertake certain surveillance powers relative to its own citizenry without making sure that those activities comply with the privacy principles embodied in the Fourth Amendment. Here again, we see that history may not repeat itself exactly, but it rhymes. And many of these same things, some of the same concepts that we're discussing now, have appeared in previous incarnations in our history, many of which I discuss in this book. And so I hope that you'll enjoy my book, that you'll read it, and I suspect that you'll come away with it with a degree of agreement on the fact that a lot of these things rhyme. A lot of the threats to our individual liberty, to our privacy that we see today, have existed previously and were some of the same things that prompted the American Revolution to begin with. But that's why I wrote this book, was to remind the American people about their own history, about their own history that too often has been written out of the books. Thank you very much.
Well, Senator Lee, this is Dean. I want to thank you so much. You've been very generous with your time. We've gone way over your stop time, but I appreciate you taking that final question. Once again, a final time, the book is Written Out of History, The Forgotten Founders Who Fought Big Government, from Senator Mike Lee. I recommend it. You've heard others. I'm already getting emails from our callers saying they're buying it online now. So thank you again for your time. To the audience as well, thank you for calling in and for your thoughtful questions. Apologies for the technical difficulties we suffered through, but we certainly appreciate you joining us. A reminder to check our calendar for upcoming Teleforum conference calls. Our next one is tomorrow, Courthouse Steps on the Rubin case, tomorrow at 3 p.m. Eastern Time at this same number. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.